protesters in Iran have not let up. Now the government has cut off internet access throughout the country.
You cannot call cell phones in Iran, and I haven't been able to reach out to anybody in Iran, neither have been able my friends.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the loss of that lifeline in Iran. Also today, a dramatic shift in U.S. foreign policy has backed European allies into a corner.
The old system does not work anymore. We live in a different world now.
The creator of a popular comfort food has died. We pay homage to Korean fried chicken.
That chatteringly crisp skin holds onto the sauce without losing its crunchy exterior.
And one ad exec wanted his chatbot to be more creative.
They are like, is it possible for me to give drugs to the AI?
Yes, drugs to a chatbot. All ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in today. First, the U.S. military seized Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Then the White House said it is actively discussing plans to take control of Greenland, which is a territory of Denmark, an EU member state. With a few notable exceptions, Europe has been pretty quiet about these stunning moves. Critics say that may be exactly what Washington is counting on. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry kicks things off for us today with a report on Europe walking a diplomatic tightrope.
Just a day after U.S. forces captured the Venezuelan leader in Caracas, President Trump made a comment on board Air Force One that left the EU scrambling for the second time in as many days.
We need Greenland from the standpoint of national security, and the European Union needs us to have it, and they know that.
The next day, the EU Commission spokesperson faced a barrage of questions from reporters.
Are you able to say that that's incorrect?
I wanted to ask about comments from Donald Trump about Greenland.
Can you just answer the questions?
This was the response of the EU Commission's chief spokeswoman, Paula Pinho.
That Greenland is has its autonomy. And of course, each country may be very interesting from many points of view, but that shouldn't trigger any interest beyond possible, for instance, business interests.
Pinho may have been caught off guard, but some say her response speaks volumes about the EU.
Each time it seems as if Europe is caught by surprise.
Sophie Innetveld is a former Dutch politician. She knows all too well how the EU operates. She was a member of the European Parliament for 20 years.
There should have been a unanimous response by the European Union and its allies saying that it is totally unacceptable. They're all squarely behind Greenland and Denmark.
Six EU leaders, along with the UK Prime Minister, did issue a joint statement saying Greenland belongs to its people, and that Denmark and Greenland only have the right to decide matters concerning their countries. But there was no direct mention of the US threats to take over the territory. Maria Martha Schütte with the European Policy Centre in Brussels says the war in Ukraine is undoubtedly a factor in Europe's cautious rhetoric.
We are a bit trapped by the Ukraine situation. We are a bit trapped that we are so dependent on the US for defense and security, because if we start threatening the US, well, what if it switches intelligence sharing in Ukraine or pulls out, you know, more strategically from the European continent?
Some EU leaders did put their heads above the parapet this week. Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, condemned the US strike on Venezuela.
La operación en Caracas supone un precedente terrible.
The attack, he said, set a terrible and very dangerous precedent. The Danish Prime Minister warned that an American takeover of Greenland would spell the end of NATO. And French President Emmanuel Macron had some harsh words for the US in a speech at the Elysee Palace last night.
Les États-Unis sont une puissance établie mais qui se détourne progressivement de certains de ses alliés.
The United States is an established power, the one that is gradually turning away from some of its allies, he said, and is breaking free from international rules that it once used to promote. But former Dutch lawmaker Sophie Innetveld says it shouldn't be up to individual European leaders to take a stance. The bloc needs to speak out in one voice, she says. The problem is many EU leaders won't agree to that either.
Honestly, every child can see now, today, you know, why we need a strong And yes, let's use the F word, a federal Europe, a Europe that speaks with one voice. I mean, the fact that there wasn't even an agreed, unanimous statement on Greenland. Hello? I mean, that's the sort of the ultimate illustration of how the old system does not work anymore. We live in a different world now.
And the EU needs to adapt to that, she says. Dave Keating, a longtime Brussels-based journalist, says the EU's hesitant approach repeatedly plays straight into Washington's hands.
Europeans in general should be very worried about the weakness that's being shown by their leaders. And we can see quite clearly that this strategy has failed. China and Brazil and India all won their tariff wars with the United States because they showed strength and because they refused to surrender.
Keating has just released a new book, The Owned Continent, all about Europe's reliance on the US. And that reliance shows up in multiple ways, he says, from security to trade. The dominance of American culture in Europe also plays a big role.
And that does create a real psychological effect. And what it's done to Europeans is it's made them unable to accept the idea that the United States is a foreign entity, that they're not part of it, and B, that it's now an adversary. It's no longer a friend.
Many political experts in Europe this week say Denmark could come under political pressure from the EU to strike a deal with the US over Greenland. Former lawmaker Sophie Innetfeldt says if that happens, what sort of message does it send out?
If Europe is not able to stop the US, then who is? And what kind of signal does this send to other parts of the world?
US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is set to meet with the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland next week. Innetfeldt says she hopes the European delegation will be more prepared this time around. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The Iranian government has shut down internet access as it seeks to quell demonstrations swelling across the country. Security forces there have vowed to respond with no leniency to anti-government protesters. Dozens have reportedly already been killed. Video shared by state TV claimed that protesters had lit vehicles and public places on fire. The broadcast also claimed that some protesters were supported by enemies of the regime, alluding to the U.S. and Israel. Sina Azodi has been watching the protests and the government's response. He is director of Middle East Studies at the George Washington University, where he specializes in U.S.-Iran relations. He said he's been unable to connect with contacts in the country since the internet blackout.
It is quite impossible because, as it was in your reporting, the internet has been cut off. Prior to, I think the day before yesterday, people still had internet connections. But last night, when there were so many people on the streets of Tehran and other cities, the government has apparently decided to shut down the internet. Even contacting cell phones in Iran is quite difficult, meaning that you cannot call cell phones in Iran. And I haven't been able to reach out to anybody in Iran, or neither have been able my friends.
And what does that kind of blackout look like inside of the country? Do you know?
Well, it means that nobody can connect to social media. They cannot receive messages on WhatsApp or any other social media apps. I do not know whether you can make phone calls in Iran. That's something I don't know because I've lost all contact with Iran. There are several reports that flights to Iran have been canceled. I don't know why, but basically I think the country is under a total communications blockade.
Can you tell me anything else about how else the government is responding so far to these protests?
Well, the rhetoric has fundamentally changed. Last week, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei made a distinction between those who are legitimately protesting on the streets, and he said that we are willing to engage with them. But then he also introduced this, you know, what he called rioters, to which he promised that they will be crushed. This week, and this actually happened this morning, Tehran's time, he simply called all the protesters vandals. He accused them of being foreign agents. And I believe that the tweet that the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made, in which he said that Mossad agents are walking along the protesters in Tehran, it really helps the Iranian government in accusing everybody of being foreign agents. And so I don't think that was really helpful.
Mossad is Israeli security forces?
Yes, Israel's spy agency.
Spy agency. So these protests started, around the economy and the dropping currency there. Have they expanded, or is that still the main, demand of protesters, is increased economic security?
Yes, as you pointed out, it was economic, but it quickly morphed into political. People have been chanting anti-regime slogans. They've been calling for the downfall of the regime. So I think while the nature was an economic protest, it is now a widespread political movement directed at the heart of the Islamic Republic.
What are you going to be paying a close attention to over the next couple of weeks to see what is to come here?
There are two things that I'd be looking for. One is the cohesion of the political elite, how they will respond. I mean, will anyone defect in favor of the protests? Mm. And secondly, the loyalty of the security forces.
Without asking you to look into your crystal ball too much, does it seem to you like defections are likely or probable?
My guess is that they will not, because the security forces that are on the streets, they're also dependent on the state for benefits, perks, coupons, and the salaries. Back in the day, the soldiers in 1979, the soldiers who defected were mostly conscripts who refused to shoot on their own compatriots. But in the case of the Islamic Republic, they've learned their lessons, and the security forces are mostly plainclothes forces who will remain loyal to the regime, at least from my understanding, to the end. So I don't believe that we will see a major defection in security forces. And so far, we've seen that, as I said, they've remained loyal. And they also believe that if they don't stand together, they will be hung separately. Mm. So this is why I believe that they will remain loyal to the regime.
Mm. Every time there are major protests in Iran, it raises the question, are these the protests to bring down the regime? Is that a useful question to be asking right now?
I think this is a question that everybody is asking. I think this is a fundamental question. And again, as you pointed out, I don't have a crystal ball, and most questions regarding Iran should start with either I don't know or it's complicated. So it is very complicated to say, but I think the loyalty of the security forces is the main factor in really calculating the outcome of these protests. Look, people in Iran are angry. They are under a political repression. They are suffering under the U.S. sanctions. But the question that Iranians have, at least some Iranians ask, is, okay, so what if the regime goes, what happens next? They've seen what happened in Syria. They've seen what happened in Lebanon, in Libya. So these are the questions that some people ask.
Sina Azodi is Director of Middle East Studies at the George Washington University. Ahead on the show...
I never sick in my life. Now I had everything.
Public health issues in Tijuana require cross-border solutions.
You cannot see San Diego without Tijuana. You cannot see Tijuana without San Diego. It's both sides. They need us. We need them.
Stay tuned for that story and more. You are listening to The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is a major cross-border problem for Mexico and the U.S. Every year, billions of gallons of wastewater laced with industrial chemicals pour into the Tijuana River and reach the Pacific Ocean. The wastewater seeps into the earth and froths up in airborne particles. Increasingly, people in the area say it is making them sick. Investigative reporter Philip Salata and a team at the independent outlet Eye News Source in San Diego interviewed more than 100 people near the river about what is an environmental, public health, and mental health crisis. He met a researcher who lost a kidney and a veteran who nearly lost his leg. These are their stories.
You're woken out of sleep. You can't go back to sleep. You're gagging in your bed.
It swoops in late at night. Even when the windows are closed, it creeps in.
It comes in like a hand, and then it just settles in your house.
It feels like a big monster coming inside your house, and it's smelling like bad and got you, and can I breathe? Help me, help me.
Anna McGrath and Kelly Vujicic live off Saturn Boulevard, not far from where San Diego's urban grid gives way to the sprawling Tijuana River estuary, which lies along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's also the site of a worsening environmental crisis, marked by billions of gallons of wastewater that have spilled annually over the international border in recent years. The binational sewage crisis is a byproduct of Tijuana's urban and industrial growth, fueled in part by U.S. trade policies. Now residents in the Tijuana River Valley say they're getting sick.
My body does not tolerate itself anymore. All the toxins just ruined me.
Despite widespread awareness of the enduring pollution at all levels of government, no comprehensive data exists on the long-term effects of exposure to the toxic gases and other airborne contaminants from these polluted flows. And residents have been largely on their own in trying to decipher the source of their illnesses. Doctors and scientists say more research and more coordinated health surveillance is needed to address the health impacts they are tracking.
We saw a huge influx of patients with diarrhea. And then we dug a little further and we started looking at the transboundary flow, the flow of sewage across the border.
That's Dr. Kimberly Dixon. She and her husband Matthew Dixon run a clinic in Imperial Beach, one of the South San Diego cities that are adjacent to the river. For lack of data, they started gathering their own.
And we started tracking, and we saw that there was a relationship. Every time there was increased flow of sewage, we could see increased diarrhea patients. And that was kind of our aha moment where we went, something's going on. We think the illness is related to the sewage. That's when we reached out to the health department and alerted them to our concerns.
Vujicic grew up near the river. She says all her life she's battled asthma, eczema, allergies, chronic infections, and sinusitis. And now, she says, she developed lymphocytic colitis, or chronic diarrhea. Her friend McGrath moved to the area in 2011. And about 2 weeks in, on a walk near the river, she suddenly couldn't breathe. She started to cry desperately. Her doctor suggested she had an asthma attack, but tests came back negative. Similar episodes followed from time to time, she said, noting her lungs have gotten weaker and weaker. Then things got worse, she said. She got pneumonia. She got tuberculosis, infections that affect the lungs.
But I never sick in my life. No, now I had everything.
Vujicic and McGrath are not unique, and neither are their symptoms, a news source learned from dozens of residents. Stories of chronic illness, like threads, weave their lives together. They wheeze, cough, or can't breathe. They get sinus infections, chronic headaches, even in children, diarrhea, nausea, they can't sleep, their eyes tear up and burn, their skin erupts in infection, they're tired, mentally foggy, depressed.
It started when I was kayaking and spending time in the ocean.
For some, the symptoms are more life-threatening, as was the case for Skip Crane, a U.S. Navy and Vietnam War-era veteran who got an infection while paddling in the ocean near the river mouth. It started with a small cut on his neck and then advanced to his bloodstream.
At one point, there was the thought that they may have to take my left leg. It was completely discolored from my toes all the way up to my thighs.
That's the sound of high school students duct taping together homemade air filters in a classroom. Scientists and local leaders have offered air purifiers and advice to shelter indoors while they advocate for broader solutions. Other proposed solutions have focused on infrastructure upgrades aimed at preventing or limiting the sewage overflows. They've come in part from President Donald Trump's administration pledging to speed up repairs on the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant on the U.S. side. Upgrades are underway thanks to $650 million in federal funding approved under former President Joe Biden's administration. But that expansion alone would not meet the demand from Tijuana's future growth. Most recently, the Trump administration signed a new agreement under which Mexico has committed to determine the possibility of expanding its wastewater treatment facilities to account for its population growth, as well as other projects. Amidst this complex problem, there is also hope, much of it birthed by a love for the river valley so many call home. The Rodriguez Dam holds a massive reservoir at the edge of Tijuana where the mountains give way to the city's urban expanse. Its waters flow for kilometers to the U.S.-Mexico border through a concrete channel. But just below the dam lies a dense patch of viral green land. There, Liliana Esparza and her team from the Mexican nonprofit ProNatura Noreste have been rehabilitating this section of the river. The project, Tijuana Rio Conecta, seems implausible. Burgeoning native plants feeding on a stream of partially treated wastewater from a nearby wastewater treatment facility. Esparza calls it a green lung.
It's a pulmón verde el que estamos tratando de recuperar aquí.
But that hope can only go so far as authorities on both sides of the border are willing to invest and plan for further growth in the region. Meanwhile, in the U.S., lawsuits are mounting.
The one thing I think everybody agrees, it is a complex problem, but the answer and the solution is really not that complex. I'm Kristen Westfall, and I'm a senior trial attorney in the environmental group for France Law Group.
While residents wait, some in the South Bay have found a new ally in the attorneys and law firms building personal injury cases against the federal government and Veolia, the international company running the wastewater treatment plant on the border. The company has blamed chronic underfunding. Westfall is a lawyer in one of those cases, but she's also a resident of Imperial Beach.
There's been an answer and a solution for a long time, and had some of these things been implemented and some responsibility been taken by the people in charge, we wouldn't be in this situation.
It would have the sound of the river.
Back on the other end of the river in the U.S., Darren Thorne sits by his piano. He and his wife Maria live close to the river. Both have had breathing problems. Both speak about the river valley with tenderness for their home. This is Thorne playing an improvised piece about the valley and the pollution crisis.
The situation that they're not going to fix the problem, really fix the problem, the sources of the problem, do what it really takes to fix it, then it really is sending a message to the people here that, and the school children and everybody in this area that you're really not that important.
The estuary, the beaches, it's a beautiful community of people, and we've loved living here. I hope that we find a solution so that we can have clean, healthy, fresh air for both families of Mexico and the United States.
And for that, sustained by national investment and accountability are a must. For the world, I'm Philip Salata in San Diego.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. President Trump has been making proclamations this week about the U.S. taking control of Venezuela's oil industry. He says American oil companies will be eager to reinvest in the country and that he, Trump, will control the revenues. Today, U.S. oil executives were invited for talks at the White House. The World's Tibisa Isaiah reports on the likely challenges ahead for Venezuela's oil sector.
Not that long ago, Venezuela's oil national company, PDVSA, was highly respected. It was one of the largest oil producers in the world, employing thousands of highly trained professionals. Jorge Robles was one of them.
PDVSA was really efficient, and it was the first world company in a third world country.
Robles talked with me from Alberta, Canada, where he now runs his own oil engineering consulting firm.
And I can tell you, there were things that we were doing back then that are better than the practices that I have seen in Canada and the U.S. in terms of how you administrate the business.
But he says that culture didn't survive the political shift that took place under the late President Hugo Chavez. Eddie Ramirez is another former PDVSA executive.
Advertimos al país que era muy peligroso que PDVSA
se politizara.
Ramírez says when things got political at PDVSA, that was the beginning of the end. In the early 2000s, President Chávez started replacing managers with political loyalists. Many executives who pushed back, including Robles and Ramírez, joined protest and a national strike. That strike ended up in a failed coup against Chávez in 2002. What came next was hundreds of PDVSA employees getting fired, including Jorge Robles.
They will not only fire us, but blacklisted us. I mean, they literally send letters to Schlumberger, Baker, and all the companies saying you shall not hire the people that we fire.
He says it wasn't long before he found a new job with an oil company in Canada, and he never returned to Venezuela. 2 decades later, the country is still feeling the effects of all this. Venezuela is producing only a fraction of the oil that it once did. Also, the country's oil infrastructure has been falling apart for years.
Al no invertir, al no hacer mantenimiento, se va deteriorando más gradualmente.
Former executive Eddie Ramírez says maintenance and investment stopped at PDVSA after things got political at the company. In 2019, U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's oil business made things worse. The country was forced to sell on the black market or to distant buyers like China and Russia, often at a discount. Over time, Venezuela's state-run oil company also became a vehicle for corruption.
Un grupo de empresarios intermediarios que han participado abiertamente en el negocio del petróleo.
Investigative journalist Roberto Denis says money disappeared into murky schemes and political favors. Now, after deposing President Nicolás Maduro, Donald Trump is urging American oil companies to return to Venezuela.
We're going to have our very large United States oil companies, the biggest anywhere in the world, go in, spend billions of dollars, fix the badly broken infrastructure, the oil infrastructure, and start making money for the country.
But experts are not so sure about that. Daniel Sternhoff is with Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy.
There's no question there are many opportunities, but the infrastructure is simply dilapidated. You don't have adequate power. You don't have processing facilities. You don't have personnel. There's a lot of things that have to come first before I think you'll see a willingness to invest.
But he says politics is still the biggest obstacle.
We have a great deal of uncertainty around who is in control and how long they will be in control.
Big foreign oil companies have outstanding legal claims in Venezuela, and they're still fighting for compensation. President Trump has said the U.S. will now control Venezuela's oil revenues. But Daniel Sternhoff says it's not clear yet how that will work.
There is no legal mechanism that enables the United States to just have control over these barrels and to market them and then to distribute those proceeds. We are most likely looking at is a negotiation.
But something crucial is still missing, says Ricardo Hausmann. He's a former Venezuelan finance minister and now a professor at Harvard.
If you want Venezuela to become investable, you have to get back to a set, first of all, a set of rules, a set of laws, a set of empowerments. I want to emphasize that the urgency to go back to democratic rule, to constitutional rule, is a prerequisite for economic recovery.
Hausmann says it's a promising bet because Venezuela has the largest oil reserves on the planet. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea in Miami.
EU states agreed to Europe's largest ever trade deal today. The deal is between the European Union and Mercosur, the common market of South American countries. That is made up of 280 million residents of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Once the deal comes into force after final approval, those residents will be able to buy European wine, cars, olive oil, all sorts of things cheaper. Europeans will be importing more agricultural products from South America. Not all EU nations backed the agreement. Austria, Hungary, Ireland, and Poland voted against it. So did France, whose farmers have been protesting the trade deal for weeks.
Ça fait maintenant des années qu'on nous bassine à nous expliquer qu'on a l'agriculture la plus vertueuse du monde.
This cattle farmer is one of hundreds who drove their tractors to Paris. He told French TV last night that, quote, after years of being told we are farmers of the highest standard, now just to sell some cars or something overseas, we have to let very low-quality meat products in. French farmers argue that Latin American beef in particular is not held to the same environmental, health, or labor standards, and that makes the new trade deal unfair. French President Emmanuel Macron initially supported the deal, but after farmers blocked highways across the country with tractors and hay bales, he changed his tune.
Le constat doit être dressé d'un rejet politique unanime de l'accord.
This is a voice actor reading from Macron's statement on social media today. We soundly reject the agreement, he declared. But Macron failed to get enough support in the EU to derail the deal. He will now have to find another way to appease France's powerful farmer associations as more meat and other Mercosur products start showing up in French supermarkets. After days of fighting in the Syrian city of Aleppo, the government has announced a ceasefire between its army and Kurdish militia forces. The fighting has forced thousands of people to flee their homes. It's been the most intense wave of violence in Syria since longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad was ousted from power. The world's Shirin Jafari explains.
Gunshots ring as residents of Aleppo flee on foot. This video was shot by a local journalist and shared online. It shows families running for safety. They're carrying suitcases. Mothers hold on to their children. There's a look of shock on their faces. One man is pushing an older woman in a wheelchair. Scenes like this are all too familiar for 26-year-old Yasser Shahrour. He's lived in Aleppo all his life, and he says he's been through a lot, especially during Syria's long and deadly civil war.
We've been in this situation so many times. For 4 or 5 years in a row, we were the riskiest or the most dangerous city ever.
Years of fighting destroyed much of Aleppo and displaced countless families. After the fall of Assad in December 2024, Shahrour says people started to be hopeful about security. They started to rebuild their lives. Some returned from abroad. But now, he says, the fear of violence has returned once again.
I've met people in the street. They were crying. They were feeling so lost. I've met one, he was telling the police checkpoint, guys, please tell me that it's not gonna last forever.
Shahrour says the man told him that he'd been displaced more than 10 times during the war, and that just recently he had finally felt like he could rent a house and settle down. The recent fighting has been between Kurdish fighters and Syrian army forces. The Kurds run a semi-autonomous region in the northeast of Syria. They lead the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, which is supported by the US. The SDF was instrumental in retaking large parts of territory back from ISIS.
It's always sad to see because really Syrians are tired of war, and I would say that Syria itself cannot take another civil war or internal conflict.
Muaz Mustafa heads the Syrian Emergency Task Force. It's an American NGO that works towards democracy in Syria. He says one of the biggest challenges that the new Syrian government faces is the integration of SDF into the national army. The two sides have held negotiations and reached an agreement back in March.
Ultimately, the problem is the lack of implementation of the March 10th agreement, the lack of integration of SDF forces into the Syrian Ministry of Defense.
There are foreign actors, Mustafa adds, that would like to see divisions within Syria. Israel provides political and intelligence support to the SDF, Mustafa says. Turkey wants to see the SDF dismantled because of its connections to Kurdish separatist groups.
What's in the best interest of the region of Syria, what's in the best interest of the fight against ISIS, is that there is a diplomatic agreement and an integration of the SDF and Damascus forces.
So far, the violence in Aleppo has left at least 20 people dead, according to Syrian officials. They say 140,000 people have fled their homes, taking shelter in churches and mosques. The U.S. has about 2,000 troops stationed in Syria. Washington welcomed the ceasefire today, and Tom Barrack, the U.S. Special Envoy for Syria, wrote on social media that the Trump administration hopes for a more enduring calm and deeper dialogue. He wrote that the U.S. is working to advance that goal. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Korean Fried Chicken. It is a huge global brand. A quick search gave me more than a dozen restaurants near just our studio in Boston that sell it. Late last year, the man credited with creating Korean Fried Chicken signature sauce died. Yoon Jung-ge was 74. To learn more about Yoon and the food he helped go global, we reached out to Kevin Kim. He's with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Asian American Center and an expert in the cultural politics of Korean cuisine.
Technically speaking, Korean fried chicken is traditionally double fried with a flour and some sort of additional starch, usually cornstarch or rice flour, to give it a very signature crisp, almost shatteringly crisp exterior. Then it's either served straight or tossed in a sweet, spicy, tangy sauce. And in Korea, that's known as yangnyeom chicken.
That sauce is what Yoon Jung-ge is credited with inventing. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, when he invented it in Daegu, which is in the central part of the country, he started this shop called Mexican Chicken, and he took the name Mexican Chicken for his sauce, which was a combination of corn syrup, gochujang, which is the fermented Korean chili pepper paste, and soy sauce.
So how did it become such a global hit? Tell me about the trajectory.
Well, I don't think it takes an expert to tell you that it's tasty. but I think to go deeper, the impact of Korean fried chicken is, comes from the history of Korea itself. You know, as Korea starts to develop after the armistice, Korean cuisine has also morphed and changed and globalized with the introduction of Western ingredients, of which we get Korean fried chicken from, in the form of flour, the form of chicken, cornstarch. The actual process of deep frying chicken really takes shape as the price of frying oil becomes cheaper because of the introduction of surplus U.S. fats and oils. And then in the intervening years, what sets Korean fried chicken particularly apart is that it becomes a kind of cultural symbol of not just Korean food, but also the customs that surround Korean fried chicken.
Yeah, I'm interested in the customs that exist in Korea for eating Korean fried chicken.
Sure. Korean fried chicken is closely tied with social occasions. And the portmanteau becomes a kind of popular pastime where friends, colleagues get together after work to share a plate of fried chicken and a nice cold beer. And it becomes a kind of social conduit. If I'm not mistaken, I think there was a recent summit that was done with some Korean companies around semiconductors that featured Korean fried chicken. So I think that just kind of serves as an important sort of cultural icon. And, you know, as Korea itself, as a political, cultural, and social force comes to the global stage, it uses food as a form of soft power diplomacy to let others know of its global prominence.
Mm. I have heard, tell me if this is correct, I've heard if you're hanging out with your friends by the main river in Seoul, there are people who will come around and sell you fried chicken, and there are people who will come around and sell you beer. So you can have your chicken and beer right there out in nature. Is that right?
Oh, that is 100% true, and I've experienced it myself. Nothing beats a hot summer day on the Han with a nice cold beer and some Korean fried chicken and some friends.
Nice. As Korean fried chicken has been exported around the world, has it retained its essential nature, or has it changed as it has landed all around the globe?
I think the answer is yes. So it's done both.
Okay.
In some ways, it has changed. As any food product and recipe does, as it migrates and crosses borders, it takes on local characteristics. So you could get Korean fried chicken with Sichuan spice or with Italian Parmesan cheese on top. But at the same time, Korean companies, since the early 2000s, have started franchising out Korean fried chicken almost the way that McDonald's does with the Big Mac. So they want your Korean fried chicken to taste the same as it does in Seoul, as it does in Boston.
What is the secret if one were to try to make Korean fried chicken at home? What's the secret to making a good one?
Well, for me, I think the way that I learned it from my mom, she throws in a little bit of rice flour, sweet rice flour into the mix. You double fry it. And for the sauce, oddly enough, my mom likes to use ketchup. That is her secret ingredient, although
straight ketchup,
it's not so secret anymore.
Straight ketchup or also with gochujang or something?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Gochujang, ketchup. And since my family's from the southern part of Korea and we like it a little spicy, we dial it up on the gochujang.
Mm, that sounds delicious. Kevin Kim is an expert in the cultural politics of food at the University of North Carolina. I have to say, I am jealous of your job. Kevin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, and bon appetit.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Congratulations are in order for a gorilla mom who just gave birth to a rare set of twins. The two infant mountain gorilla twins were spotted clinging to their mom over the weekend in Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The park is the largest and oldest in Africa and was set up to protect the endangered subspecies about 100 years ago. Mountain gorillas used to be critically endangered, but thanks to conservation efforts, the population is bouncing back a bit. Now, roughly 1,100 mountain gorillas live in the wild. Or actually make that about 1,102 now. AI is entering the workplace in all kinds of ways. People in creative fields might use prompts like, give me 5 possible endings for the screenplay I'm writing, or generate some logo ideas for my new company. One ad exec in Sweden has not been wowed by AI's ideas, and after some hand-wringing, he decided that what ChatGPT really needed was to get high. Yes, on drugs. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
ChatGPT already offers a menu of characters in audio response mode. They each have a name and a little descriptor to help you choose, but they all kind of sound the same.
Hey there. I've got a really great feeling about us teaming up.
Well, thanks, Juniper, for being so, quote, open and upbeat.
Hi there. Nice to meet you. I'm excited to help you get things done.
Thanks, Maple. Cheerful and candid.
Hey, it's great to meet you. I'm really looking forward to working on some cool stuff together.
That was Breeze, animated and earnest. They're all really earnest, aren't they? Upbeat, positive, ready to go. But if I'm a creative, do I want that?
No, says Swedish ad exec Peter Rudvall, not one bit.
So in my experience, working with it creatively has been utterly trash.
Trash because of the way AI is written, he says. Its algorithms are based on logic, its answers straightforward, its goal to please.
A lot of people identify themselves with having the same problem as I had. They want to use AI as a creative tool, but they're unable to. Because again, the rational thinking, which is a fundamental design, isn't made to get new ideas.
Or to be weird. And weird, says Rudvall, is what he needs when he's brainstorming ad campaigns. And then he thought, who does say weird things? Well, for one, people who are high on drugs.
And that made me like ask myself, so this is a wild idea, like, is it possible for me to give drugs to the AI? Like, the obvious answer to that is no. No, how could you do that?
Certainly not by, say, blowing a bong hit at your computer screen, Rudval says, but he had another idea, to scrape the internet for all the open source scientific data on what people say and do when they're stoned to the bejesus.
Make that into code to sort of break its logical thinking and reroute that brain to emulate what's happening in a human brain while on weed, for example.
This is something that normal straight-laced ChatGPT can't do very well. I ran my own experiment. Here's ChatGPT's Maple, sober, answering a simple query. Listen, quick question. Who invented the peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
Gotcha, no worries at all. And as for the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, it's not tied to one single inventor. It sort of evolved over time. Peanut butter came about in the late 1800s, and the combination with jelly really...
And then I inform Maple that she's just burned a bowl of cannabis and now has the munchies.
I love the creativity. Well, in that scenario, I'd probably get a bit more philosophical and say something like, you know, man, the peanut butter and jelly sandwich is kind of like the ultimate snack, born from the love of two simple things coming together. But at the core, it's still that gradual evolution we talked about. Always a fun spin, though.
Pretty tame stuff. Clearly, Maple is just playing along, merely imagining what it's like to be high. Now, here she is with the help of Rudval's weed coding, which, by the way, at this point only generates written answers. So I feed the text back into normal ChatGPT and get this.
Okay, yeah. We're going way past cruising altitude now. Like seatbelts, dissolved, dashboard, melting, sandwich, becoming a concept.
Maple's just warming up.
Peanut butter is the earth. Dense, ancient, ground-up legumes that remember being plants. Jelly is light, fruit, sugar, sunlight trapped in a wobble. Bread is the plane of existence they agree to meet on. And humanity? Humanity is just the hands. Slightly sticky, curious, a little hungry.
This is bonkers, but actually helpful. Rudval's coding does just what he'd hoped. It turns ChatGPT weird, whimsical, and less logical. Rudval's also written code for cocaine, ketamine, and the mind-bending natural hallucinogen ayahuasca, among other drugs. He recently asked an ayahuasca chatbox to dream up a new system of governance. It suggested people vote with their DNA.
Their DNA.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, okay, even though that's far-fetched, something is happening in my brain. And that's the beauty of this, because then I get an idea and ping-pong it back and forth with this AI.
Ping-ponging new ideas with AI. Rudval considers this a breakthrough, and apparently so do others. He's sold his code to hundreds of other creative types looking for inspiration. Mostly it's for work, but Rudval says people are starting to use his code in their personal lives.
To having that as a sort of companion to combat male loneliness, if you want to talk to the AI, maybe you want the AI to vibe with you on the same wavelength that you are. So it could be kind of plausible, actually.
Better with weed than cocaine, I would imagine. That could lead to trouble.
Maybe. I mean, I have alcohol in there as well, if you want sort of a unhinged ChatGPT version on a Friday night.
Drinking with an unhinged version of ChatGPT on a Friday night. Rudval says one client just wrote saying he'd bought the booze plug-in for his brother-in-law as a birthday present. But if it's real chatting you're after, his marijuana code won't let you down. Maple still riffing on the PB&Js.
The sandwich was inevitable. The moment peanuts learned to dream of being smooth. The moment grapes realized they could become memory. The moment bread said, I can hold this.
You know what's maybe the coolest part of Rudval's code? The next day, you don't have to rack your brain to remember all the random concepts and connections, or maybe even ad campaigns you and stoned AI came up with, because there's a transcript of it all right there online.
Honestly, the PB&J isn't food. It's a mandala you can eat.
For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
A portable yin-yang, a soft reminder that the universe sometimes solves hunger with vibes.
The world. World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Happy Friday. Come back again on Monday after you eat that peanut butter jelly sandwich.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.